The parable tonight is seats at a wedding feast. Seats at a wedding feast. Now, this story is a trap. It's a setup. The Pharisees have been trying to get Jesus any way that they possibly can. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to trap him into some type of misstatement, some type of sinful action, so that his reputation will be ruined and that the people will quit trying to listen to him. I think that's probably what happens constantly in politics, where that people are always doing their best to make the other guy look like that, you know, he is the worst thing that's ever happened. And to be honest with you, it's effective. I think that politics has gotten to the point to where it's the lowest common denominator. And so I think that's what they're trying to do with the Lord Jesus. Now, I want us to remember that in this time, and really if you go to this part of the world today, this is a very important thing. And that thing is called hospitality. Hospitality is a big deal. Now, even in America, especially in the South, I think, that's where I've spent most of my life. But in the South, hospitality is a big deal. When you go to somebody's house, they want to feed you. I know when my dad would get off from work, he got off like an hour and a half before my mom got off. He would go by and see his mama, and he was supposed to come home and eat at our house, but he would go by her house, and she'd have food on the stove, and he'd eat with her, then he'd come home and eat again. And I guess that's why at the end of his life, he was huge. You know, your mama just wants to feed you. Well, that's the way it is with a lot of ladies in the South. I was telling Brother Keith a second ago before the service began, I said, I made a mistake. And he said, what is that? I said, well, my wife told me later, or this afternoon, she said, now when you leave, because she's still not quite up to snuff yet, she said, when you leave, I want you to get 2 jars of pepper jelly. And you give it to Brother Keith so he can give it to Miss Kim so she can give it to her mother. In other words, she had a domino effect that was going because Brother Keith's mother-in-law, she loves that pepper jelly. And so Deb had made some, and so she's going to give it to Keith's mom-in-law. And so anyway, I walked out and forgot it. But Deb, in a true Southern fashion, she's wanting to give somebody food. And so that is a culture that was extremely important in the day of the Lord. Now, when you had a meal, especially if it was a banquet type meal, there would be choice seats that would be there, and the people that were to have the honor, they would be the ones that would have the chief seats, choice seats. I think back to my daughter Allison's wedding, and we invited the whole church, and I think there was about 230 or 40 people that showed up for the wedding, and we had a meal for everybody in the Family Life Center. But at that wedding, there was a table that was set up for the Foskeys, and there was a table that was set up for the Fagans. The guests that came, they had tables that they would sit out, but those two tables were the chief seats or the choice seats, because it was the bride's family, the groom's family. And so that's kind of the mindset that I want you to think about tonight. And you've all been to banquets where there was a head table, and then there were other tables. Years ago, Debbie worked with a lady that was Muslim. And they had a lot of conversations about religion and that kind of thing. Well, The lady loved Debbie. It just seems to be a common denominator, you know. Everybody likes Debbie, all right? I tell people all the time, if it wasn't for her, the church would run me off. And so, anyway, this lady had a daughter, and she was marrying a boy that was a Hindu. Now, that was weird. And it wasn't too long after 9/11. And so Deb goes, we've got to go to this wedding. And I said, well, where's it at? Downtown Atlanta, the Hilton. Okay, when do we have to go? It's a Saturday night. Okay, what time? Well, the meal that we're a part of doesn't start till 9. Well, I'm telling you right now, these days on Saturday night, I'm in bed by 9 o'clock. I mean, I'm usually up on Sundays and, you know, pretty early getting at it, because Sunday's going to be a big day. And so she goes, we don't have any choice. We got to go. And so we got there, and I'm going to tell you, it was different. It looked like something out of Arabian Nights. The groom, he had shoes on that was like multicolored, and it had little curls on the front of it. And the girl, the bride, she had things like dripping off of her head like jewels and all of this. And I'm thinking, these people got to eat. I mean, now it's already 9:30, and the couple hadn't showed up, but everybody else is there, and they're just kind of, you know, walking around, and I'm thinking, I'm hungry. Hadn't had anything to eat and don't really know if I want to, but if I recognize something, I'll get it. Do you know that we did not start eating until like 11:15? And I told Debbie, I said, I'm eating this rice and I'm getting out of here. I said, I got to go. And so finally we were able to ease out just as the couple got there around 11:30. And I'm like, this is not a good way to have a wedding. But do you know that's the way that they do it in Oriental cultures? That's the way that they do it in the Middle East. They have huge, lavish banquets. I thought we were doing something just by having Matthew's cafeteria cater ours. But boy, not these folks. I mean, they put on the dog, so to speak. And so this is an opportunity for people to come and really have a great time among people that are respectable. That's a key. And so, not only were the people excited about going, but the host. He was able to show his affluence. He was able to show his wealth. He was able to show his standing in society. In other words, I'm the guy that foot this bill. I'm the guy that did this. And so that is the background for our text tonight. Now, I want you to look with me beginning at verse number 1, and we're going to see how that there is a provoking of the hypocrites. And it came to pass, as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees. So you have different levels in the Sanhedrin. You have some that are like the high priest, which was a Sadducee, not a Pharisee, by the way. But they were in the upper echelon there. So this guy is a chief Pharisee. He's not one that just got in. He's one that maybe was still even in waiting. Maybe he was not even one of the 70. But yet he had been accepted into the club, so to speak, of being a Pharisee. And so he is there, and he's a chief Pharisee. And the occasion is to eat bread on the Sabbath day. Now, that's kind of curious to me. Why would they have this on a Saturday when it was supposed to be a day of rest, when all of the people that would be there would have to be served, which meant that the servants that were doing the serving would have to work on the Sabbath day. But I don't think that it was necessarily about just the meal. I think that it was about getting Jesus. Look at the end of verse number 1. They were eating bread, having a meal on the Sabbath day, that they, the Pharisees, that had all come, they watched him, Jesus. Now they knew that he has done things on the Sabbath day prior. One of the first things that I learned in my first year of Bible college when I took New Testament survey was something called the Sabbath day controversies. Before I got to college, I had no idea what that was. But I learned quickly that what it was the things that Jesus did on Sabbath, and the Pharisees hated him for it. Now, there are 7 healings or miracles that the Lord did on the Sabbath day. We read about, I think, one of them possibly last week. But you have one in Mark, Peter's mother-in-law. That happened at a place called Capernaum. You had a man that had a withered hand. I think I told you the joke whenever about this, about, Lord, make my hand like my other hand. And he did that, all right? Mark chapter 9, the man that was born blind. Who did sin, this man or his parents? Matthew chapter 12, I know we talked about this, how that the disciples went through and plucked the ears of corn and would break the husk off, and they would eat it as a snack. What about Mark chapter 1? There was a demon that was cast out of a man. Luke chapter 13, the healing of a bent woman. The lady was a hunchback. All of that happened on the Sabbath. And then tonight, there is a man, and he has, we would call it the dropsy. Verse number 2 tells us about him. And it says, behold, there was a certain man before him. In other words, he's there in front of Christ, and he had the dropsy. Now, this is a disease where that it's like you retain water. We might even call it congestive heart failure today, where that water begins to build up and maybe gets in that sac around the heart and begins to put pressure on you. There's not probably a week that goes by that I don't hear about some person, usually they're elderly, that is not suffering from some type of water retention swollen glands, kidneys that are not functioning because they're overtaxed, livers that are having problems. Just all types of problems with, I guess, the term edemas. And so we have this man, and he has the dropsy. His kidneys, his lungs are malfunctioning. He's probably swollen as he's sitting there, maybe in some agony. I don't know how the man got there, but I know that he was invited. I don't know if somebody carried him like those men carried the guy on the cot that broke up the roof where there was 4 of his friends. I don't know how he got there, but I know that he was there. And I know that he was there before Jesus, as Jesus is standing there, and he's watching the people come in. He sees this man. And Jesus, seeing this man, he says, let me ask you guys a question. Now, he knows what's in their heart. It didn't take Jesus by surprise that they're trying to trap him. He says, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath day? Well, it says they held their peace. In other words, they didn't answer. Well, if they would have said no, they have a problem, and Jesus is going to tell them about that in a second. If they said yes, then they would say, yeah, but you can't work and do things on the Sabbath. So they held their peace. And then Jesus took him, the man that that had the dropsy, the man that had that edema and was retaining all of that fluid, it says that he took him. I'd get that to mean that he literally reached out and he physically touched him, possibly lifting him up, and healed him and let him go. Now, in my mind, and I don't know how we could think about this any different because it does not tell us that he went home and took Lasix. It does not tell us that Jesus said, go to your house and in 3 weeks you'll be okay. No, it says that he took him and healed him. And when he healed him, he did it instantaneously. That's one of the big problems that I have with quote unquote faith healers. They want to heal something that you can't see. They want to claim something that cannot be verified. This you can see. This is verifiable because it happened right in front of their eyes. The man that is there swollen, where he looks like the Michelin man, all of a sudden he begins to lose the puffiness. He begins to now, instead of having no energy, he begins to have strength come back into his bones. He begins to kind of feel a surge. And the next thing you know, this man that could barely walk is now doing anything he wants to do, just like everybody else. All of that happened while Jesus is holding him, and when he is healed, Jesus lets him go. And so they hold their peace, they see what's happened, and it is a Saturday. The Sabbath day is in full swing. And before they can say anything, Jesus answers them saying, which of you shall have an ass or an ox fall into a pit and will not straightway pull him out on the Sabbath day? So in other words, Jesus throws it back at them. He knows the answer. There's not a single one of them that if he had a donkey or a cow that had fallen into some type of dry well or some type of pit, would not do everything that he could to get that animal out of that hole, even on a Saturday. Now, there are times when people, they take their Christianity extremely serious. They want to be as dedicated as they can, and so they don't let anything come between them and church. Years ago, we had a man in this church, and I think this is the man, when I heard the story, I'm thinking, that's him. We had a man, I had his funeral, me and Brother Don had his funeral, and then I had his wife's funeral. But we had a man named Leo Levinka. When Leo was a member of Forest Hills, when Dr. Hudson was there. Later on, Leo became a deacon at this church and was a part of the building committee. He had worked for the United States government with FEMA, and so he knew plans back and forward and that kind of stuff. But he loved God, and he loved souls. And I mean, if church was open, he was going to be there. He came home from work one day, and his wife said, Leo, we got a problem. There's water everywhere. Water standing in this house 3-4 inches deep. It's Wednesday. What are we going to do? He said, do the best you can and get dressed. He somehow got a drill. I don't know if it was an old handheld operator one. I hope it wasn't an electric one. At least one that you plug in. He found the lowest part in that house and he drilled some holes in that floor so that the water could drain out, and he and Elsie went to church. Now that's dedicated. But I cannot imagine something happened like that at my house. I'd call Chad and say, hey, you need to preach today. I got my ox in a ditch. I need to take care of it. There's not one of these guys that would not have done exactly what Jesus said they would have done and asked them, who of you that had an ass or an ox in a ditch wouldn't get him out on a Sabbath day? And so what does it say? It says, and they could not answer him. In other words, he checkmated him. He made sure that when he asked this question, he knew that they would have done it just like he healed that man. Now, had they said anything, he could have looked at them and said, so it's more important and it's more valuable for an ass or an ox than it is to heal a man? Is a man not more important? As a matter of fact, is not one of your men? Because you see, this guy had been invited to the Pharisee's house. This was not some guy that they considered to be a wicked sinner. He certainly was not a tax collector. He was one of their buddies. So in other words, you're telling me that I shouldn't have healed your friend on this day? And it says that they could not answer. And I would go so far as to say that they would not answer because they knew they had been checkmated. And so we see that there is a provoking that takes place. But there's also, number two, a positioning of the Pharisees. Now I want you to look with me at verse number 7. And I thought this was pretty cool. He put forth a parable to those which were bidden. The word bidden means invited. The people that were invited, and what did he do? He marked, observed, paid attention to how they chose out the chief rooms. The word rooms there is a word which means seats. Doesn't mean that they had a room here, room here, room here, room here. It means that they were all in one area, but there were chief seats, just like there was a Foskey table and a Fagin table. And Jesus marked them. I thought it was kind of interesting the way that verse number 1 says that they watched him, and now the watched has become the watcher. And so you've got Jesus, and he is watching them. Now, it is a great honor for these people to be invited, but it is an even greater honor when you're a chief guest, because it is a seat that is basically elevated. Now, when I say elevated, it could have been on some type of stage. If you go to some type of a big, huge public function, sometimes, just like I'm standing on a platform tonight, some people would say we're standing on a podium, and they would be exactly right. This is not a podium. And I hear preachers, I'm standing behind a podium tonight, and I'm screaming, no, you're not. A podium is what you stand on. A pulpit is what you stand behind. You say, how do you know that? Reader's Digest. 35 years ago, I read that, and a podium is the same root word of podiatrist. It is a foot doctor. And so it has to do with your feet and your standing. And so you have special seats. Perhaps they're elevated, but there's something that is set apart about them. But what has taken place with these guys? They had not waited to sit down. They went and they were finding the chief seats, the seats of honor. So what are they doing? They're being arrogant. They're being arrogant in the way that they're acting. How would you feel if somebody came to your house for the first time, and without being invited, they just started walking through your house and opening cabinets? You'd go, that's different. Now, if you've known somebody for a while, you may walk over and say, I wonder if they got something to drink. You open the refrigerator. But if you were there for the very first time, you would not do that, because you have not been invited. You're not really in that inner circle yet. Now, there may come a time when that's it, but not now. These guys are invited. There are chief seats that are there, but they had not waited for the host or for the servant to take them to their assigned seats. They're thinking that they're superior to others. When I think about that, I mean, you can see that all over the place. In just a moment, I'll give you a couple of illustrations. But do we not live in a society today where a person thinks that they may be superior to everybody that's around them? We absolutely do. Get out of my way, old man. Get out of my way, old lady. You hold the door for somebody and they walk in and don't even say thank you. Don't even get a grunt. I heard Bob Jones III tell this in a sermon one time. He said, I was at a supermarket and he said, I saw a lady coming and she had a little dog. And said she's walking with her nose up in the air. And he said, I held the door open for her and she walked through and didn't even say anything. And he said, I just yelled at her, you're welcome and so's your kid. Well, these people, they felt like that they were so special that they said, hey, look at that. I think I'll take that seat. And so he says they marked how they chose. The third thing is the parable itself. And this is a parable that unmasked them. Verse number 8. He says this, when thou art bidden of any man to a wedding, sit not down in the highest room or the best seat, lest the more honorable, lest the groom's family shows up and says, hey, that's my seat. And thou be bidden of him, and basically you're going to be bidden to move. Now, how many of you have ever flown on an airplane? Raise your hand. Some of you fly a lot. I usually fly to Israel. I may fly a couple of other places every year or so, but I don't fly all the time. I know Andy used to get on an airplane almost every week. But I have observed this in my few times that I've been on an airplane. I've probably flown 15 or 20 times. Pulling in, nice little landing. That's a good thing. And all of a sudden, pilot comes over the intercom. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for having a good flight today. And what we need you to do is, as we taxi to the ramp, what we need you to do is we need you to stay in your seat. And when we get stopped, then you can unbuckle and you can get your belongings and we can exit orderly. While that plane is moving, I'll bet you a dollar to a donut this happened to you. Somebody that is superior to everybody else, probably a bunch of them, they start popping them seatbelts open, they start standing up, and that plane is still taxiing. And they start opening up there, and the stewardess is going, back up, I didn't mean to say stewardess, the flight attendants, sir, please sit down. The plane is still moving. You don't tell me what to do. If he had done that at the beginning of the flight, he'd have been taken off the flight. Now he don't care if he's taken off the flight because he's where he wants to go. But you've seen those folks and it's like, I've got to get my backpack before anybody else gets their backpack. So what can they do? They can grab it and they can move 3 feet only to be stopped by the next person that's done the exact same thing. And for literally 2.5 seconds, they've gained. And they're arrogant. And all I'm thinking is, I hope you trip as you're going out the plane. I hope that your purse goes all over the place. I hope your backpack goes all over the place. Why? So we can laugh at you under our breath as we go by. You've seen it. Now, how many of you have seen that on a plane? Oh, don't lie. You've all seen it. What about when you're out on 285 and you're clicking along, you're in the right lane or the middle lane, and you got somebody that comes up in the emergency lane and does a death move between the two of you that's next to you and yourself, and you're thinking, that guy missed me by 2 feet. Back when we were having to go back and forth to St. Joseph, I'm telling you, there were times when it was like, man, we could have been killed 3 or 4 times out there on that road. People are nuts the way they change lanes and how fast they go. And they think that they are so quick in their reflexes, when in reality, physics, if you're going 80 miles an hour, you're not going to stop, you know, from here to Carl. That's just not going to happen. And so you've got people in their attitudes and they think, hey, man, I'm just special. Now, in verse number 8, he's talking about those that are not to sit down in the chief seats, lest the more honorable comes, and then when you are bidden of him, the guy that did the inviting, he that bade thee or he that invited thee, come and say to thee, give this man place. In other words, the same man that put on the banquet or the meal, this wedding that they're going to have a big soiree, he invited you and he invited the guy that you're sitting in his seat. He invited both of you. But this man has got more honor, and the man that put it on in his mind than you do. Give this man place, your place. That's his seat. And thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. In other words, you're going to basically go sit by the kitchen door. You're going to be going to a place that is not the choicest. But instead of being happy that you're there and you're going to be able to have food that you don't get normally, you're going to jump the line. That's a real problem in my mind. And so when we see that this man comes and he says, you got to get out of that seat. Look at verse 11. It says, for whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. In other words, he's giving these instructions to the guest. Now, can I tell you that we Christians are not to act like these guys? We ought to prefer others before ourselves. We ought to make sure that other people are honored. And if we will have that type of humility, we will ultimately be honored. I didn't put it on your notes. I just kind of put it on mine. But I want you to look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5. 1 Peter 5, verse 5. This is basically talking about the pecking order and how that we're to honor those that are older than us and how that we're supposed to prefer others before us. But it gives us the exact way, in my mind, that we're supposed to do this. He says, likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. In other words, if you're 25 years old, you don't start barking out orders to somebody that's 45 years old. Those guys may have something in their experience of life that you don't have, and so don't think that you know everything when you're younger. Get a little experience under your belt. Get a little more study under your belt. Yea, all of you, in other words, older and younger, subject or submit one to another, and be clothed with humility. Arrogance has no place in the Christian walk. We ought to be humble. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, walking around, you know, with your face, you know, look like that you've been eating prunes. I'm talking about there ought to be a humility in the way that we live, where that we are trying to prefer others and not have the preeminence. He says, if we're clothed with humility, God resisteth the proud, but he giveth grace to the humble. James says this. He says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. Now, I guess you probably know this, but there are certain epistles in the New Testament that are called the Jewish epistles. You have Hebrews, you have James, you have 1st and 2nd Peter, and you have Jude. All of those guys are written predominantly to Jewish Christians. And so you have Peter, and he's talking about humility. This is exactly the situation that Jesus is referencing here in our parable for tonight. In other words, it's part of Jewish culture, and can I say that it ought to be part of Christian culture? There ought to be humility in the lives of God's people. And so he is giving instruction to the guest. But he doesn't stop there. He goes on to give instruction to the man that put on the big banquet. The man whose son or daughter was getting married. Then he said also to him that bade or invited him. So in other words, he goes from talking to a group to talking to a man. When thou makest a dinner or a supper, can I tell you that there's verses like that, whether in the South you have dinner at lunchtime and you have supper at night? Now I know that when we say, hey, you want to go to dinner? Now we mean nighttime. But at one time, a dinner was at lunch and supper was at night. And so, when thou makest a dinner or a supper, call not thy friends. Now, does that mean that we should never have dinner with our friends? Certainly not. But just think about it. If that's all you ever do is just eat with your friends, how is that going to always honor the Lord? Nor thy brethren. In other words, your family. It talks about your kinsmen. If you're all just eating with your cousins, how is that expanding the kingdom of God? What about thy rich neighbors? Lest they also bid thee again, and a recompense be made, or are they going to return the favor? In other words, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. We can have this, and then we can have that, and you can elevate me, and I'll elevate you. In other words, it is wealthy people, and they're hanging out with wealthy people. You take people that they have been blessed materially, but they only hang with people that have been blessed materially. Jesus says to that man, look at verse 13, but when thou makest the feast, in other words, when you're putting on a big soiree, he says, call, invite the poor. Call the maimed. Call the lame. Call the blind. He did not want to do that. The only one that I see in this text that he called that had some type of malady was the man that got healed in verse number 2. The majority of them were healthy as they could be. They were as wealthy as they could be. And so he says, if you really want to show what kind of a good man you are, verse 14, they'll talk about like righteousness and doing recompense. But if you want to show how good of a saint you are, how good of a follower of the Mosaic law you are, he says, if you will invite the poor and the maimed and the lame and the blind, he says, when you call them, you'll be blessed. Now, why is that statement there about they can be blessed? For they cannot recompense thee. If we found somebody that didn't have a nickel to their name or two copper pennies to rub together, they don't even make coppers anymore. All right? They said it costs more to make a penny than the penny is worth. I don't understand that. They've already got, you know, the stamping machines. But evidently they're smarter than I am. But they don't even make pennies anymore. The only time that you get a number that's not a zero or a five, most places, they either round up, very seldom they round down, or you pay by a debit card or credit card. That's when you get the six, seven, eight, nines and the two, three, fours. All right? And so you've got these people and they cannot give you anything in return. When you think about that, you think, well, how am I going to benefit? If you keep reading, it says, if you will do right, if you'll care about people that are needy besides just those that have more than their heart could even want, and you will do something to help those that have true needs. Now, I'm not talking about giving something to some guy that hadn't hit a lick at a snag in 20 years. Paul said that if a man won't work, he shouldn't eat. I agree with that. I go so far as to say that if you're on government assistance, you ought to do something if it's nothing but picking up cans on the side of the road. If you can walk, you ought to do something. Just my opinion, and that was free. But if you have someone that is truly in need, and you do something for them, God will take care of that, and he will bless you for that. He says, for thou shalt be recompensed. When? At the resurrection of the just. When I think about doing something in the name of the Lord, God pays attention to every little thing. The same way that they were watching Jesus and he in turn was watching them, so God watches every time a sparrow hops along the ground. I thought about this verse last week and again this week. The chickens that we have, I think that they get tired of just the same old thing. I mean, I know that there's some people and they say, there's your chicken feed, that's it. But I buy other stuff. Sometimes I'll buy bags of sunflower seeds. Sometimes I'll buy bags of wild bird seeds. I'll buy anywhere from a 3-grain scratch to a 7-grain scratch. And when I'm pouring that feed into the container, I'm always scooping and putting more stuff in there, kind of to give them, you know, kind of a smorgasbord, as Brother Don would say, a smorgasbord. But they've got a smorgasbord of things. And I noticed this, that after they have eaten and they've kind of started going off and start scratching around looking at other places, there's about 30 or 40 little baby birds. Now, I don't know if they're sparrows or not, but I know they are tiny, tiny little birds. And where are they at? They're out there next to those chicken feeders. Well, they're not big enough to eat the pellets. But those little baby seeds from the wild bird seed, there's 30 or 40 of those jokers out there, and they're just pecking away. And they're eating that. And so you have people that can't do anything to help you. But God will take care of the birds, and God will take care of you, and God will not be beholden to anyone. If we give, and we give to the needy, God will bless us over and over and over again. I think about how that God has blessed this church, and I'm astounded at how well this church does. We went through COVID. We've gone through other things. And the Lord just keeps on. I look at the mission giving and our faith promise from last year to what is promised this year is an increase of like $6,000. I've been getting letters right and left from missionaries. Sometimes it's in the form of a card. Sometimes it's an email that's sent to me. And they would just say, we just want to thank you for the extra offering that you gave us at Christmas. The last 2 years, we've been able to give like $14,000, $15,000 on top of what we normally give to missions. Why? Because God's people love to help needy people. And God has blessed this church over and over again. I believe that God has blessed this church because of the way that we emphasize widows and orphans. The book of James says that if you care for the widows and orphans, that's pure religion. It's undefiled. And so God has blessed us. Can I tell you, I beg you, let us not ever get to the point to where we're an arrogant bunch. It's not about us, it's about the Lord. I say let's let the Lord elevate us. Let's let the Lord give us places of honor. Let's do our best to try to be Christians and not Pharisees. And so what do? We take the lower seat and let somebody else come and elevate us and give us glory.